You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Ward Shelley. Ward, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hello. Nice to hear your voice.
Ward, let's talk about what you're doing at the moment in your practice. We're talking on Christmas Eve 2020. It's a very strange time in the world. We're at the peak of the pandemic, it seems, or maybe not quite yet, or something, but this is the pandemic year. So I'd like to ask what you've been doing, what your studio practice has been like. It could be now or recently. So much of your work is often interactive and involves other people. So I'm wondering what's been happening in this recent months or recent year.
Okay. Well, it was a strange year, and I usually work with somebody. I have a couple of partners that over the last couple of decades, I've split my work off into two directions. And I've been working on an idea for a show to do with my friend Doug Paulson. And we tend to work with words a lot and ideas. And we have a series of things called the Complete Archive and the Lash Library, and they come together. They've actually joined and appeared in various iterations. And this year was not only the COVID year, but it was also the election year, and the election just seemed to be at least as important as the pandemic, and actually very related. So we decided we wanted to do a piece before the election about what was going on with the election. And the idea that most interested me was the manipulation of public opinion for people with power. And I used to be in advertising. For a short period of my life, I was in advertising, and my parents had been through psychoanalysis and were very they talked a lot whenever I'd be sitting in front of the TV about advertising that would come on. And I got very used to the idea that people, when they're talking to you in any source that's otherwise free, that it wasn't really free. They were, trying to tell you something or trying to get you to do something that maybe wasn't a good thing for you to do. So that was the place that we started. And we wanted to do it at my gallery, the one I work with, Pierogi, in New York City, and talked to Joe about it early in the year, and it didn't seem to be the right thing for him at that time because everything was up in the air and the economy was a big question mark. But as the summer approached, he saw that that business was a problem for everybody, and the galleries. An interesting thing over the decades I figured out is that when economic times are good, people get serious about trying to make money. And when economic times are bad, artists get to do whatever they want because there's nothing much to lose. So Joe called me back and said, whatever you wanted to do, we'd love to have you do that. So we had a chance to work on this show for September, which was, enough in front of the election that we could really talk about the political and informational world that was unfolding. It's never been anything like that in my experience. You know what I'm talking about?
Of course.
So, Doug and my wife and I convened at this location in Connecticut, which is really my studio, but I haven't been there. I hadn't been there for 8 months. And Doug had a job that fortunately was still keeping him busy, and so he was not able to come out all the time. But we worked out there in a very nice setting out in the summer under the trees and constructed this kind of it was kind of a diorama, kind of a forced perspective diorama of this place where information is analyzed and manipulated for the ends of a small group of people who have a reason to try and make people do stuff that they probably shouldn't do. And we installed that at Pierogi, and it was actually meant to be seen through the window. Like, we didn't know because of the virus whether people would be willing to come into the gallery. You know, but they could come by and look through the window. So if you set something up a little bit like a Christmas on Fifth Avenue kind of window display, you know, if you just use that as your kind of proscenium, your frame, and then set the whole thing up. So we made this this room that looked like it went on for a long time. I'm sure you saw the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, the first Indiana Jones movie.
Right. Sure.
Yeah. Well, and you remember the last scene of that movie? It was they had everybody gone through all this crazy stuff. They're running and trying to find this ark, that came from the Bible, from biblical times, and was connected to universal power and things like that. And at the very end, after all these people have gone through lots of exertion and people have lost lives and the world's been turned upside down, they put the ark in a box. You know, basically the ark is this thing that holds these scrolls. And they put it in this back in this room, and you see it on a forklift, and it's going in this place in this warehouse that seems to go on forever. The camera pulls back, and there's just boxes and boxes and boxes, and you just feel like it's getting lost again, you know, that it's going to disappear and somebody like Indiana Jones is going to have to find it again. But for me, it was that scene of pulling back and seeing this thing going on forever. And when we started making the archives, it's all based on cardboard boxes. And to tell you the secret is that they're empty, but they're all labeled. They all look like they came out of a systematic, you know, they all seem to be like they were made in a factory, a handmade factory, and they all have labels, and inside them they have stuff according to the label in the box. And that was the whole idea, is that you would suggest contents, and the contents would react to the other contents next to it, and you would basically get these ideas of things that could go in the box. And most of them were kind of absurd, but it was a really great project for Doug and I, because he's got a very different sense of humor and ironic sensibility. I tend to be a bit more strident and moralistic, and to have us play back and forth, we would get this stuff rolling, and to take on this idea of this room full of boxes where these guys got together and held up their charts, and you know, they would have people like Roger Stone come through there every once in a while and give them tips on how to promote Steve Bannon and Donald Trump and get the masses to line up with their ideas. That was the idea. So the thing unfolded in this kind of way, and it was a really fun project to do, and it was all designed to be seen through a window. But you could still go inside, and then it would be, you could see a lot more if you went inside. And we had it up, you know, for a month. Actually, 6 weeks, I guess, at Pierogi. And it was great to get something up before the election and get your 2 cents in. And it's a weird time for all the galleries now. You know, they're just, literally the show that was taken down when we came in and to do our installation for September was the show that had been installed in March. And I guess that was happening on a lot of the galleries. They just had these things and realized that nobody was going to come, and they left them up because they felt bad that the artists hadn't, you know, and that's the scene for everybody. And even with things like people who made movies that were supposed to be released, you know, just everything that one could rely on in terms of a venue, was the rules were changing, and people weren't going out. And I'm sure that this is a topic, right, that's come up with a lot of your guests and artists, is that everything is like different, And for most of us, maybe it's not too bad that we're dealing with some stress. There's a lot of people who obviously are dealing with bad stuff too. But everybody's have to rethink things, you know, and maybe things won't go back to where they were. I know with me, it's been, it's given me a lot of chance to think. You know, an artist very often, he spends time or she spends time thinking about the content and the form of their artwork, right? And, you know, like, what is it I got to do with the paint here or with the message here? And it's, you spend a lot of time like that. And then the times that you have more time to think about it, then you start thinking about the reception of your work, like how it fits into society, where it's going to come out, what it's going to mean. And for me, this last few months has been like one level above that, but like, why am I doing this? You know, what is it that I want to get up and spend my life on, you know, my life, which is way more than half over. I'm 70 now, so I'm thinking about what I want to do with the years that remain in front of me, and how much I want to invest in the things that I've done up till now, and whether I want to like write some new chapters.
Well, that's a profound kind of reckoning, really, and it seems appropriate for this time of the year and the type of year we had, but also, as you say, being 70 and having had such a, you know, broad experience and worked in so many different ways, that sounds like a powerful way to move forward. So what chapters do you want to add? Is that the question that's still just outstanding there, or are there things, and I don't mean for you to tell me your resolutions now, but, you know, in the decades ahead, as you're talking about, what is it that you want to do more in your practice? Because, yeah, you have so many parts of your past that you could, you know, yeah, tap into and revisit or on so many levels. So what chapters are you thinking of adding, or what would you like to accomplish in the next decade or so?
I find that I can't just walk completely away from the things that I've used to construct my identity, even though I may have done them enough, that that's how I bring meaningful things into my life. So I can't just completely walk away from doing an artist's work in the studio. But I don't want it to be quite as obsessional as it was. And I kind of feel like that there's more room for me to be receptive instead of productive, if that makes sense. You know, like I think that I wanted to make an impression. I felt like I had something to say. It's a kind of maybe a narcissistic tendency among artists that they think that they actually have something to say and they want people to hear it. But I also think that I could do a lot more listening. And I don't mean even just to the artist. I mean to the world in general. So I feel like I want to be receptive and not have an agenda every day of what I want to get done. Kind of feel like I want to listen more to my wife. That would be really good for the relationship. And I also am looking at the world. I'm lucky enough to live near woods and like to spend time in the woods and just sort of have that that connection to our reality that has existed before us and in some way is not dependent on us, and that knows something that we should be listening to. And do you know what I'm talking about at all?
I do. That's powerful. And what I want to ask about that is, and this is even like drilling down on something more personal, because I, of course, relate to that and I understand that. The idea of listening takes place on a lot of layers. And the layer to me here that struck me most was listening more to my wife, which would be helpful for the relationship. You know, we're like as artists, right, as thinkers, everyone has visions, ideas, you know, or they're part of a protest or a movement. You know, but historically, it's always kind of relationships that tend to get neglected by these great thinkers and creative people, right? So,
yeah.
And that's everything, right? Like in every great movie, you know, love seems to be kind of what we're about. Not that that's really exactly what you're saying here, but
I agree.
Though. Tell me a little
I
bit.
Agree.
Yeah. So what does that mean exactly? Because you know that makes me sort of stop and think. Yeah, I have to listen to my wife more too. What does that mean to you? How is that a different way of listening? Because I understand it in the context of, you know, as a person in the world, in a changing world, to listen to all types of viewpoints. But to listen to your wife is something else. What does that mean?
Well, part of it, I think, is probably just to have more time to just be around her. And I mean, she actually has a very enriched life with her girlfriends that she's been friends with for 30 or 40 years. And they have lots to say to each other. They don't get bored with each other. And I think it's interesting to imagine me being part of that, or me, you know, I'm much more of an activity person, and so as a model, you know, that's a different model to try and work into my life. But I think really, I'm just talking about letting, not me being impatient and jump starting my agenda for the day, but listen to what she might want to do. She's very agreeable. She goes along with me, but I tend to be the one who has a hair trigger and pulls that trigger first. So we end up doing things the way I want to, or, you know, we just take off on my stuff. And I think that it takes a lot of patience to actually wait for another person's clock to get ticking and get going, and I think it would be good for both of us for me to learn how to wait a little bit and just find out what she is into. I know, I mean, certainly she's not shy about pushing back once in a while, but that's not the best way for everything to, you know, get into a conversation, is that she's got to get to the point of pushing back. So I guess what it is me learning how to wait and listen to her, and you know, I get impatient and want some activity. And
I do too. I do too. It's very interesting, and yeah, I mean, you're talking about and this does seem, you know, that it's involved with art and a way of thinking and in your work and even studio practice. But you are talking about, I mean, in the larger context, we're talking about what you're moving into or looking forward to in terms of your practice. But this is about a different way of approaching the conversation itself, and I mean that literally, right? We're talking about the dynamics of a conversation, which can be. You know, fraught with everything from ego to not listening to, I don't know, other things that's challenging, right? Because we're talking about like words themselves, how they're used, as well as like the length of time you listen before speaking or something, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah. And those of us who think that we're, you know, that we have something to say, maybe we aren't normally patient enough to give a room to other people. I mean, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't stand up and say the stuff that are important, you know. And I'm sort of transitioning out of the domestic relationship into the world at large. You know, I mean, I think it's been an amazing year for voices that have otherwise gone unheard. The last few years, I mean, with the Me Too movement and the Black Lives Matter movement, I mean, these are all voices that we knew were out there, and they've had a lot to say that affected us a lot. And I think that it wouldn't be wrong to say that, you know, that my personality has something in common with white guys who just run around doing the stuff their way, whether they're doing it, you know, that doing stuff for my wife. I do stuff for my wife all the time, and I get a lot of pleasure out of it. But it's not the same thing as listening, you know, because it's still an agenda of mine. Part of it is just, you know, that I think it's my role to be the initiator. And if I didn't do it, then everybody would be disappointed or I'd be not fulfilling my role. But I think that, you know, as I see that I can grow a little bit, and one of the areas of my growth is to take less responsibility for control, or less control. That's really the word right there. Having a little bit less control of everything that's going on, and allowing other people or other agendas or other things that they don't really need everything to be coming from me, and I could actually maybe benefit too, not just. I mean, that's the great thing about the future, I hope, is that people will start to learn that there is a benefit to not being the boss all the time, you know, and for either for your identity niche to be the one that's calling the shots all the time. But there's actually a lot to share is actually maybe beneficial for not just for the disadvantage, but for the people who thought they had the advantage, there might be a benefit to sharing, if you know what I mean.
I do, Ford. Thank you so much. I think I should leave it there because that's a lovely thought. And I want to ask you one more question, which is, what are you reading at the moment?
Oh, that's right. Well, I finished a book this year, and I kept it on my desk because I've been keep flipping through it. It's called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. And his name is spelled Haidt. He's a social and moral psychologist. And that book just opened up an awful lot. I kind of got drawn to it because earlier, like just sort of reviews about the book talks about, it sort of opens up the difference between the liberal mind and the conservative mind. But it goes a lot deeper. It drives down to really interesting things. I recommend that book to anybody who just doesn't, who feels like they would like to understand better why people aren't all like them. To sort of see that there are reasons that other people feel differently about stuff than you, you know. And that's, I would say that it's for those people who, you know, I love the notion of being woke, but I think that one of the things that on another level of wokeness might be to understand why the people who are doing the things that are messing up the world, actually why they're there, why they're like that, and as well as yourself, why you know. So I recommend that book, The Righteous Mind. I could talk more. I've been reading a lot. I've been reading about the Beatles lately.
Tell me more. I'd like to know whatever else you're reading. What have you been reading about the Beatles? I just saw the initial footage from the Get Back sessions that looked pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing, right? Well,
this is rewriting history in a sense. We know the Beatles as having this acrimonious breakup, and Yoko John were sulking in a corner, and instead it looks like the absolute opposite, you know, from the footage of that so far. But I mean, I digress. But
I never thought it was Yoko that broke the Beatles. You know what I thought it was that broke the Beatles, and I haven't heard anybody else say this, but I pieced it together, and that is what I think. It's because each of the Beatles, they were so codependent with each other, interdependent, that as they got the good reception from the world and validation over and over again that they were okay, they were tired of having to get permission from each other to do the things they wanted to do, because they always have to come together and collaborate and they hear what the other guy said that they didn't like about what they were doing. And I think this is especially true of George, that he felt that he had proved that he was, you know, a peer, but they still treated him like he was their younger brother, that he wasn't as talented as they are. And I think that even between Paul and John, they just got impatient with having to get permission to do what they wanted to do. They decided it was just too much trouble to have to, like, to be stuck within their collaboration, that they wanted to be able to actually open it up. But that I haven't read anywhere. That's just my projection.
Yeah, it's such a collaborator. Kind of fascinating thing, like what actually happened there. My feeling about that keeps changing as history gets revised on that. But that the Beatles breaking up was kind of a mistake, a misunderstanding that they didn't actually all intend that to happen. And you know, there was some footage recently. I think it was from these sessions that are being edited now. Let It Be, where the Beatles are talking about what the next album could be. And one of the ideas was it could be each of us taking, you know, a whole section of it to do our own songs, you know, kind of like what you're saying. But so maybe George would have had his, you know, All Things Must Pass moment then or something. And I kind of think it was mixed up with touring and Paul's ego and a misunderstanding. But it could be, nobody knows, I guess, really what happened. But
it's never a simple story.
It's what? No,
it's never a simple story. Yeah. I mean, and if you think you've got a narrative that explains it all, then you're definitely missing something. You know, we depend on narratives for clarity, but the world is more complicated than we have the ability to actually, you know, completely understand. So that's why we rely on
that. Absolutely. Well, and the past is different for all of us. Like, I was just thinking yesterday when hearing that thing about the Beatles, how I think it was John Lennon that said, you know, when there was this whole push for so many decades of will the Beatles reunite? And John Lennon at one point said, does anybody want to go back to high school? He said, how could we do that and how could that work? You know what I mean? It's like, that's a nostalgia fantasy. It can't happen, like literally. And so and what else? So was there something else? So you're reading about the Beatles? Is that
they made a book called The Beat Anthology that came out 20 years ago when that series of CDs came out called Beatles Anthology, that were all like outtakes and things like that had never been released on Beatles album before. And I think they even made a video series at that time that was related to that. But this book is as big as a telephone book, and it's every word in it was said by a Beatle. They basically went to all the interviews that had ever been done that they collected. They tried to collect everything. It took me years to do this and try to use just the Beatles' words to tell the story of their not only their childhood but also blow by blow, in a chronological time frame of their whole career. And it's pretty great. It's pretty great. It's slow going, a lot of words. It's really long, really big. And you know, I can do it, you know, but then later I put down a book and get something else, you know. But it's there, and I'm at the same time I'm reading a book called All the Songs. And there's been a few different books and put together where they actually address each individual Beatles cut from the very beginning, and they talk about how it was recorded and who wrote it and who sang and played guitar and if somebody played cowbell on it. And so, and I've been trying to do them in at the, you know, keeping them at the same point in time going through them, and it's about as big as a telephone book too. So it's kind of a fun project. It's a great kind of pandemic project to have these books that I can go to and dig into, and it's like a, you know, like a Talmudic scholar.
Ward, thanks so much for talking with me today. It's been such a pleasure hearing about your work projects and what you're reading. Thanks again for talking with me today.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.